Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, and thank you for coming tonight on such a bitter cold night. We really appreciate it. Everybody's faces have this rosy glow. It's kind of sweet. But we are very excited and honored tonight to have author Chris Cleave here, actually back here with us at Tattered Cover, with his new edition of his debut novel, Incendiary. Many of you, of course, are familiar with Chris Cleave's second novel, Little Bee, that was shortlisted for the Costa Book Awards and has been a New York Times number one bestseller. Incendiary is an award-winning book as well, and in 2006 won the Somerset Maugham Award and was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Unfortunately, the initial release in England of Incendiary coincided tragically with the 2005 London terrorist train bombings. There's more to that story, which I'm sure Chris can tell us about. But right now, in 2011, we're grateful for the new release of Incendiary, and especially grateful to Chris Cleave for coming back to Denver to the Tattered Cover to talk with us tonight. Please help me welcome Chris Cleave.
Thank you all so much for coming out this evening. You know, it's freezing cold out there. It's really nice to see so many of you here. Thanks for coming. You don't owe me an audience. I'm incredibly grateful to see you. Thank you. And thanks for supporting Tattered Cover as well. This is a truly amazing bookstore. This is the second event I've done. I was at the other branch of the store before, but incredibly welcoming and really skilled booksellers. And I think that supporting your local independent bookseller is one of the most important things you can do as a reader or as a writer, actually. I think that independent booksellers do something in this country and in my country, the UK, which is very undersung and understated. But the cultural impact that independent booksellers have in breaking out new writers and bringing them to the public is something that no one else really does, and I've certainly been really grateful to it. Certainly for my last book, Little Bee, I don't think it would be anywhere without independent booksellers, so I'd like to thank you very much for supporting Tattered Cover tonight. So if some of you have read my first published novel here, Little Bee, you might not know that I wrote a story before that was published, which is this one, Incendiary. I wrote it in 2004, and I wrote it because a few different things were going on in my life. The first thing that happened was that we'd just had a kid. The kid at that point was 9 months old, in the spring of 2004. And if any of you have read Little Bee, you actually know my kid already. When about 3 years later, when I came to write Little Bee, there's a character in the book called Charlie, and he also goes by the name of Batman, because he won't take off his Batman costume. And he's very much based on our first kid. You know, our first kid went through a Batman phase, which I think a lot of young boys do. I'm still growing out of mine. He was amazing. We had three Batman outfits for him. I realise I'm digressing terribly here. We had one that was on him, the one that was in the washing machine, and one that was drying out, ready to go on him. And he used to go around with this very stern expression on his face all day, kind of like this, under his mask. And if you asked him what he was doing, he would just tell you that he was fighting crime. He's a great kid. He's seven now. You'll know him a little bit if you've read Little Bee. But when he was 9 months old, you know, before he'd started to do Batman, before he'd started to talk, when he wasn't even walking yet, you know, we were already really in love with him. And it was a very sort of strange time to have a young child, because it was still, this is still in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, right? Of September the 11th, 2001, which was quite an interesting day for the whole world. Right? You didn't have to be American to realize that the whole world had changed. I was living in France on September the 11th, 2001, and the headline of the main newspaper in Paris, Le Monde, on September the 12th was, "We're all Americans now," you know? And France has gone on to prove that they aren't. You know, but you've got to applaud the sentiment, right? There was this sense that we were all about to be precipitated into a new kind of world where you had to choose your sides. And I think that's been proved right. You know, it has been a different world since then. And it hasn't stopped getting weirder. And it hasn't stopped becoming, you know, harder and harder to work out what you're meant to do as a parent and how you're meant to bring up a kid these days. Because, there, you know, it's not obvious. And it certainly wasn't obvious to my wife and I. Because you have this young child and everything that you do is geared to helping this child survive. I mean, the age that our first child was at this point, he was very curious, very mobile, and he had absolutely no common sense at all. So everything you do is to try to stop your kid falling down the stairs, or to stop him opening the cupboard where all the poison is, right? Or to stop him sticking his fingers into live electrical outlets. You know, everything you do is geared to survival. And then you come up after the first few months of that, you learn a little bit better how to manage that situation, you relax a little bit more, and then suddenly you realize that you lift your gaze up to the horizon and you suddenly realize that, oh, the whole world is dangerous. The whole world is a very difficult place to be bringing up a child into. And as a writer, this started to concern me more and more. And to think, well, okay, how can I write about this weird sense of dread that I feel about having a child in this world? This was March of 2004, when two different things were happening. In Madrid, in Spain, in March of 2004, there was an Al-Qaeda-inspired bombing on their transit system, in which 200 people died. And this was a big deal in Europe because it was the first Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorist attack in Europe. And it felt very much as if this situation was rolling and was engulfing the whole of Western civilization. And then also in the spring of 2004, there were news stories breaking about the atrocities that were being committed in Abu Ghraib. And a lot of you will be familiar with the news pictures that there were of the torture that was being carried out in that prison by people who are, we thought, on our side, right? As in part of the British and American forces that were working in Iraq. And so in the wider world, on both sides of what was then being called the War on Terror, there were these terrible atrocities being committed, these horrible acts of violence. And you could see a way in which the world was becoming consumed by this cycle of violence. On the other hand, in this quiet domestic setup that my wife and I had with our new child, everything was rosy, you know? You think, this is great. So on the family level, everything's fine. On the world level, everything's really dangerous. And I wanted to write a book about it. So I decided to write a book about a mother whose son and her husband are lost in a terrorist attack, an imagined terrorist attack, on a soccer game. In London, which is the city I live in, because I wanted to examine what would happen in the aftermath of that attack. Now, we hear a lot about carnage, we hear a lot about violence, we hear a lot about atrocities, but then the news agenda moves on, and 6 months later, it's very rare to actually get a feature about what's going on in the everyday lives of these people who've been touched by violence. And I think that's something that you can do as a novelist, is examine the whole life that follows after that, after the news agenda has moved on. And that's what I wanted to write about. So I wrote about this woman who's lost her son. And she decides to write to Osama bin Laden to persuade him that what he's doing is wrong. Now, it seems like a crazy and stupid and naive thing to do. But my question is, well, why don't people do that? No. Why do we think, and this is a question, you know, this isn't a statement, but why do we think that the way to counter violence is with large-scale, organized, systematic violence? It's just a theory that this woman has, the narrator of the book. She decides that she can persuade Osama bin Laden with words to renounce his campaign of terror. She thinks that he's a guy who just doesn't get the idea of love. Thinks he just doesn't get it, and thinks that if she could persuade him, then he would change his mind and he would change the things he does. And so, and that's where the sort of fun starts with the novel, because actually, how do you explain to someone who just doesn't get it what love is? It's the hardest thing to do. It's really hard to explain how love makes you feel about things and how love makes you sometimes do things that are illogical and irrational. It's hard to explain what it is. And she starts by just explaining what a day was like with her son, you know, the kind of things she did. And these are the kind of stories that I like to write. I like to write simple stories about ordinary people's lives that, in the context in which they're being told, tell a bigger story. I guess I should read you a bit from the book, and you can see for yourselves, I think, you know, the effect that I was trying to go for with it. And afterwards, by the way, I'm really interested in your questions about it. So, you know, don't be shy. And if there's any questions that come up, please do ask away. This is incendiary. Dear Osama, they want you dead or alive so the terror will stop. Well, I wouldn't know about that. I mean, rock and roll didn't stop when Elvis died on the Kazi. It just got worse. Next thing you know, there was Sonny and Cher and Dexy's Midnight Runners. I'll come to them later. My point is, it's easier to start these things than to finish them. I suppose you thought of that, did you? There's a reward of $25 million on your head. But don't lose sleep on my account, Osama. I have no information leading to your arrest or capture. I have no information, full effing stop. I'm what you'd call an infidel, and my husband called working class. There is a difference, you know. But just supposing I did clap eyes on you. Supposing I saw you driving a Nissan Primera down towards Shoreditch, and I grassed you to the old bill. Well, I wouldn't know how to spend $25 million. It's not as if I've got anyone to spend it on since you blew up my husband and my boy. That's my whole point, you see. I don't want $25 million, Osama. I just want you to give it a rest. Am I alone? I want to be the last mother in the world who ever has to write to you a letter like this. Whoever has to write to you, Osama, about her dead boy. Now, about the writing. The last thing I wrote was not applicable on an income support form that wanted name of spouse or partner. So you see, I'll do my best, but you'll have to bear with me because I'm not a big writer. I'm going to write to you about the emptiness that was left when you took my boy away. I'm going to write so that you can look into my empty life and see what a human boy really is from the shape of the hole he leaves behind. I want you to feel that hole in your heart and stroke it with your hands and cut your fingers on its sharp edges. I'm a mother, Osama. I just want you to love my son. What could be more natural? I know you can love my boy, Osama. The newspaper says you're an evil monster, but I don't believe in evil. I know it takes two to tango. I know you're vexed at the leaders of Western imperialism. Well, I'll be writing to them too. As for you, I know you'd stop the bombs in a second if I could make you see my son with all your heart for just one moment. I know you would stop making boy-shaped holes in the world. It would make you too sad. So, I will do my best with these words. I suppose you can see they don't come natural to me, but I hope this letter reaches you anyway. I hope it finds you before the Americans do. Otherwise, I'm going to wish I hadn't bothered, aren't I? Well, Osama, if I'm going to show you my boy, I have to start with where he lived, and I still do. I live in London, England, which I agree with you is a bad place in lots of ways, but I was born here, so what can you do? London looks like a rich place from the outside, but we are most of us very poor here. I saw the video you made, Osama, where you said the West was decadent. Or maybe you meant the West End. We aren't all like that. London is a smiling liar. His front teeth are very nice, but you can smell his back teeth rotten and stinking. My family was never rotten poor. We were hard up. There's a difference. We were respectable. We kept ourselves to ourselves. And we kept ourselves presentable. But it was a struggle, I don't mind telling you. We were not the nice front teeth or the rotten back teeth of London. And there are millions of us just like us. The middle classes put up websites about us. If you're interested, Osama, just put down that Kalashnikov for a second and look up Chav, Pikey, Ned or Townie in Google. Like I say, there are millions of us, but now there's a lot less than there were, of course. I miss them so bad, my husband and my boy especially. My husband and my boy and me lived on Barnet Grove, which is a road that goes from Bethnal Green to Haggerston. There are two kinds of places on Barnet Grove. The first kind are very pricey old terraced houses. The estate agents call them Georgian gems with extensive potential for conversion to fully appointed executive flats with easy access to the City of London and within a stone's throw of the prestigious Columbia Road flower market. The second kind of places are places like ours. They're flats in dirty brick tower blocks. They smell of chip fat inside. All the flats in each block are the same, except that the front doors don't match on account of they get kicked in as often as they get opened nicely. They built our tower blocks in the 50s. They built them in the gaps where the Georgian gems had incendiaries dropped on them by Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler was the last chap who hated London as much as you do, Osama. The newspapers call him the most evil man in history. And he made the gaping hole in Barnet Grove that they built our tower block in. I suppose it was thanks to him we could afford to live within a stone's throw of the prestigious Columbia Road flower market. So maybe Adolf Hitler was not all bad in the long run. Like I say, our flat was in one of those tower blocks. It was a small flat, and you could hear the upstairs neighbours on the job. They used to start very soft at first and then louder and louder until, after a bit, you could listen as hard as you liked and still not know if you were hearing love or murder. It used to drive my husband crazy, but at least our flat was warm and clean, and it was ours. It was an ex-council flat, which is to say that we owned it, which is to say that we didn't have to struggle to pay the rent. We struggled to pay the mortgage each month instead. There is a difference, and that difference is called empowerment. Now, I think I'll stop there. Sometimes I think that listening to a writer read their own stuff, sometimes, you know, you want to... you can go on a bit too long with it. So I might read a bit more later on if you'd like. But I thought I'd stop, first of all, and answer any questions that you might have. Because I think that in these live events, that's the most interesting and the best thing to do. Because I'm really here, and you could ask me anything, and you could read the book anytime. Hi.
I know this is a little bit written on your website, but can you talk a little about when the day the book came out and
Yeah.
How they call the book.
Very interesting. Yeah. So I don't know if everyone caught that, but the question is, could I talk a bit about what happened on the day that Incendiary was published? It was published on the 7th of July 2005. So my book about an imagined Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorist attack on London was published actually on the day that there were some real Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorist attacks on London. Upwards of 50 people died in coordinated bombings on the London transport system. So there were some bombs, suicide bombers, on the underground trains and one on a bus. Now, the effect that had was pretty devastating on the city. It very much changed the way that people lived in the city for quite a long time, actually. And I think for the first time we understood the magnitude, not only of what had happened in London, but what had happened in America 4 years previously. No, because what happened on 9/11 was several orders of magnitude bigger, you know, than what happened in London. But still what happened in London was absolutely catastrophic and devastating. One of the effects was that my book was taken off sale by most retailers. So it had been on the shelves for about 3 hours, and then it was taken down. I think, and that was actually a very interesting lesson for me. I mean, I'm the kind of writer who tries to write stories that are about reality. You know, they're about contemporary life, and I write about news events because I'm convinced there's this thing you can do in fiction, which is to have the time and the space to explore emotional truths behind the facts of the news. You know, there are things which are no less true for the fact they're emotional and they make you cry, you know, or they make you laugh. Still true. I think you can do that in fiction in a way that you can't in the limited space that you get in print news. But I think one of the risks that you take when you decide to inhabit that space as an artist is that real life is going to be bigger, right? And I think what happened to me on that day was that real life became bigger and more interesting. And I think as a writer, you have to learn when to step away and say, okay, you know, I was writing about real life and then real life happened. You know? So I'm still very proud to work in that space, which I think about it as a space that starts when newspapers get bored of a story and stops when historians start being interested in a story. You know, it's a 7-year window that's really, you know, like fresh snow, and there's no footprints on it, and you can inhabit that territory as an artist very usefully, I think, because you can contribute to the discourse around events that are really happening. But sometimes real life becomes bigger, and on the 7th of July 2005 it did, and I had to step away, and we couldn't promote the book at all, of course, because 50 people had died, and that was just more important, you know? But it was a crazy day. We had on the London Underground, for example, thousands of posters. I mean, this was going to be a big bestseller for the summer for my publishers. We had thousands of posters around the London Underground network that had an image of the London skyline on fire. And the date, 7th of July 2005, which is the publication date of the book, and the headline, "What If?" question mark. And these are posters, you know, as high as that wall, all over London. So one of the first things we had to do was take those posters down, you know? And it makes you think, you know, the hubris of it, of that as a marketing campaign, like the sheer arrogance of me, you know, deciding that I was going to write about a terrorist attack on my own city, you know, and the unbelievable unpleasantness of what happened when that really happened made me ask some quite soul-searching questions about, you know, why have I done this? You know, why did I want to write this story? Is it ever right for an artist to imagine acts of violence set in a real place? You know, when there are real consequences of those acts of violence, how do you disentangle the critical response to the violence from the critical response to the piece of art? In the weeks after the 7th of July attack, I had some vitriolic articles written about me in the newspapers. And they called the book tasteless, exploitative, you know, as if I had written it on the more, you know, when I read the news headlines. But you know, this is a time of madness. You know, in the time immediately after a huge tragedy like that, the rules really go out of the window, and everyone starts to inhabit an illogical, irrational, emotional, artistic space. And what I discovered that was really interesting in the aftermath of the 7th of July attacks was not the fact that I, as an artist, had gone further towards the world of news than is usual in a novel, but that the world of news had become art, right? And all of these, all of the rules of logic had left the building in terms of news coverage. So there are a lot of people saying that the book should be banned. There were a lot of people saying that I should be ashamed of writing it. There were a lot of weird discourses going on in the society. On the one hand, people were saying, we will not let these terrorists change our way of life, while simultaneously our way of life was being changed beyond all recognition. We introduced these rules under which terror suspects could be interned without trial for extended periods. We still have a problem with the standards of evidence that are applied to terror cases in the UK that are different from the standards of evidence that are applied in general law. You know, a lot of things have changed in our legal system. A lot of things have changed in the way we're policed as a society in the UK. But at the same time, we've held this discourse, we've held this line all the way through, that our way of life will not be changed. You know, so we're a society that is able to believe opposite things. And slowly these opposite things reconverge. But it takes a long time after a big shock, like a terrorist incident. So I thought it was really interesting to examine not just what happens in the book, but what the critical response to it was after the attack. And that's something that you learn when you inhabit that weird space between the news and history.
As a consequence of this wild coincidence of the publication of the book and that day in history, did that spook you from writing again?
Yeah, that's a good question. Did it spook me, the coincidence of the book and the real events in London? Yeah, it freaked me out totally. I mean, totally. It's very easy now at a distance of years, 6 years, to look back on it and say, yeah, actually what happened was I was writing in the spring of 2004 in response to some things that were happening in the world. And the length of time that it took me to write a novel was about the length of time that it took these five young men from the north of England to put together a suicide bomb plot. And it just so happened that both of those projects came to fruition on the same day, right? My response to the violence of the world, trying to talk about it in words peacefully, and their response to the violence in the world, trying to counter it with their own kind of violence, right? Two very different reactions to the same sets of events that came to fruition on the same day by macabre coincidence. It's very easy 6 years later to look at it like that. But at the time, you know, as speaking as someone who had 2,000 posters on the London Underground with the smoking London skyline and the date and the headline "What If?" and a book that goes on to be very rude about Osama bin Laden, you know, and which isn't, you know, it's not an anti-Islamic book, but it could be construed as an anti-Islamic book by certain people. For a long time, I thought it was my fault. Yeah, I thought that the bombings were a response to this very high-profile publication of what would be construed as a blasphemous book. Stranger things have happened. You know, in the UK, there were riots about the publication of a book by Salman Rushdie, which was construed as blasphemous to Islam a few years before. And for 2 or 3 days, I assumed that there was a possibility that I might have had something to do with it, which, looking back on it now, seems like pure hubris. But at the time, I wasn't in my right mind. It had shocked me that much. No one claimed responsibility for the attack, ever, you know, as far as I know. I mean, I think they found some martyrdom videos afterwards. But I was waiting for the next statement to be, yes, and we did it in response to this blasphemous book. You know, so I moved out of my house. I moved my family to a safe place. I was completely spooked. And for months, I got hate mail and death threats, and all of these things, some of which were taken very seriously. But something I'd like to talk about and put on the record, because it's amusing, is that of all the death threats I got, and all the ones that were actually serious, were not from Muslims. Right? I've actually had, from this book, a very positive response from the Muslim community, for which I'd really commend them. The most serious threat I got was from a hardcore soccer fan. And this is because about 30 pages into the book, there's a sustained terrorist attack on a football match on the home ground of Arsenal Football Club. And a very hardcore Arsenal fan had taken offence to this. You know, I'd blown up his football team, so he was damn well going to blow me up. There are people like that. They walk amongst us, you know. And he was taken sufficiently seriously to be picked up by law enforcement, and he had he'd left death threats and messages, also on my publisher's answer phone and on my publicist's phone. And he was taken really seriously, and he was picked up and charged. And I just thought, you know, in the final irony in a long and twisted story of this book, how weird that the most serious threat came not from from Muslims or from people who felt offended by the book on religious grounds, but from a guy who was cross because I'd blown up his football team. a lot of the things about this book have taught me some lessons. You know, there is a lot of violence in the world, and people do take words extremely seriously. And it made me, like, the extreme reaction to this book, which actually goes on to be, I think, quite a funny book in places. It's dark, it's twisted, but it's a love story. It's a story about a woman that really loves her kid. And I was amazed by the fury of some of the reactions against the book. And it really made me realize that people take words very seriously. And it made me actually stick to my original premise that it's important to try to defuse violence with words. Because, think about this, if it's possible to create violence with words, right, then you're admitting that there's a link. Right? You're admitting that you can say something here, and by whatever direct transmission or mutual amplification or butterfly effect or chaotic ripple, violence will happen sometime down the line. Well, if you're admitting that, then you also have to admit the counter-argument to that, or a logical corollary of that, which is that it must be possible to defuse violence with words also, by the same mechanism, by patience, by persistence, by explaining esoteric concepts like love in a way so that people who didn't get them suddenly get them. That can actually have a positive effect too. And I think that, viewed in that way, this whole concept of the war on terror becomes absolutely fascinating, and it means we are all involved, right? Because they're not calling it the war on terror anymore, but that's what it was called, you know, for 7 years. And you know, I think when you declare war on a noun, you admit that language is on the front line of that war, right? We're all involved. And I actually see the world in a way now where the opposite of terrorism is not the military action that we might engage in to stop that terrorism. Actually, the opposite of terrorism is an episode of Friends. You know? I'm serious, right? The opposite of terrorism is the quiet conversations that we have. You know, the opposite of terrorism is light entertainment. You know, it's beautiful. It's actually really beautiful. It's harmless. It's life-affirming. Like, movies, music, bands, theatre, opera, books, politics even, you know. Mathematics, engineering, all of these things are the opposite of terrorism. There are these constructive efforts to create beauty using words and ideas and, you know, melody. Because for as many as there were sort of damning and visceral and complicated and difficult responses to this book, there were some really positive responses too. I like the fact that still, in an age where we have all of these media that books have to compete with, I like the fact that a book can still become something that people find important enough to get angry about, as well as to love. You know, that was a really important lesson that I learned through the book. I think the response to the book was more interesting than the book itself. You know? I shouldn't be saying that. My publishers will kill me. But I like the book. Yeah, I think it's my best work, actually. It's certainly the thing I've written that I'm most proud of. But when I look at it from a pure intellectual point of view, the reaction to the book was so interesting as well. You know, I think being a novelist in the age of the internet is a completely different and new job, because with every book comes this whole corpus of reaction that is connected forever to the book now, and it becomes part of the piece of art. You know, the response to it. That was a long answer to a short and good question. Sorry, madam.
How much time went by, or how long did it take for Incendiary to come out after they took it off when it was first...
What a good question. How long did it stay off sale? And when did Incendiary come back after the bombings? Well, it's a really interesting question. It wasn't formally withdrawn from sale ever, right? So back in the day, a book could be censored. You know, for example, D.H. Lawrence's work was officially censored and had to go to court years and years later before it was allowed to be put on sale. This has happened to a lot of work, but recently that doesn't happen. Governments know that if they censor a book, authorities know that if they censor a book, that will just, like Obi-Wan Kenobi, make it more powerful than they could possibly imagine. So what happens now is this weird sort of censorship by the marketplace. You know, my publishers never said to booksellers, please take this off sale now. Booksellers just did it. You could get copies of it in brown paper bags, you know, that were held literally under the counter. It wasn't on the shelves, and nothing was said. There was nothing that I could do. Yeah, I couldn't make a stand and say, look, they've taken my book off sale, but I defend it because it's a book about love. And it was just taken off sale because it was deemed to be tasteless in that climate. Whereas I maintain to this day that there was never a more relevant time to read that book than in the months following the 7th of July attacks. And I had email from people that were victims of those attacks, who were injured in those attacks, who read the book and really thought it was an important book. But I still feel quite freaked out that historical moment for the book was missed, you know, and I do feel, even whilst admitting that art is never as important as real life, you know, that the fate of a book is always going to be less important than the fate of 50 people who actually died. Even whilst admitting that, I'd still, you know, defend my right as an artist to talk about the time I live in, and I found this sort of censorship on grounds of taste by retailers to be really insidious and difficult to make a stand against as an artist, because there's nothing you can push against and say this has happened. But I would say it was about a year before it started to come back on sale because of this this thing that happened, which is that I won a literary award. I won this thing called the Somerset Maugham Award, which is a good thing to win in the UK. And sorry, I was just trying to give some background to it. I wasn't trying to boast, but the and it started to be taken seriously critically, and people actually started to say in big newspapers things like stunning rather than tasteless. You know, it's really interesting. The New York Times lead critic, you know, she called it a case of simple tastelessness. You know, in the immediate aftermath of the 7th of July attacks. But a year later, you know, they made it one of their books of the year and called it stunning. You know, and you suddenly realize that you actually, if you're talking about real life, you can't dissociate the context of the art from the art itself. The critical mind doesn't separate the two. And so I had to wait for about a year until people were ready to read the thing. And then it did really well, and they made a movie out of it with Ewan McGregor and Michelle Williams in it, and it became a book like any other after that. But it took I'd say it took about a year, and I think this is really interesting, not just for my book, but when you look at all of the books out there that you are not allowed to read right now because they're too close to the bone, right? All of the books that I'm not allowed to read in my country because for some reason the market has decided that they're inappropriate. This is a weird age we live in where governments don't censor art anymore, but the market does. You know, and I think a very interesting example actually is not from the realm of art, but in the realm of politics. I'm not taking sides on the issue that I'm about to mention, and I don't have a comment on the rights or the wrongs of it. But if you look at what happened with the WikiLeaks fiasco, where information that belonged to the US government was stolen, released into the public domain. I don't know the rights and the wrongs of that. What I find fascinating as an artist is how that got shut down, because you had a combination of government agencies working with internet service providers, retailers, including Amazon, and newspapers, to close the thing down. You had companies like PayPal and MasterCard stopping payments to these organizations that were not illegal organizations. And in that way, enormous pressure was put to bear on a piece of information. This is a piece of information too. You know, the WikiLeaks was a piece of information. It was closed down not by act of government, but by collusion of entities that I didn't know worked together until a few weeks ago. You know? And that, I'll draw a parallel between what's happened to that and what happened to a book like mine. Because it's not governments that censor art anymore, it's the market. And that's something that I learned from the experience. So it's a long answer to, again, a long answer to a short and good question. So I just want to say thanks very much for listening. You've probably realised by now that some of my answers are very long. And I want to thank you very much for your courtesy and patience and kindness. So thank you very much indeed, and it's been fun. Thanks a lot.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Foden. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.